life when truth and righteousness have been neglected and forgotten. An avatar is born to relight the flame of religion in the heart. Sri Krishna says, "When goodness grows weak, when evil increases, I make myself a body. In every age I come back to deliver the holy, to destroy the sin of the sinner, to establish righteousness." As if to fulfill Sri Krishna's promise, Buddha appeared. At the time of Buddha's birth, spiritual culture in India was at a low ebb. It consisted wholly in the observance of rituals and sacrifices, for people had forgotten the simple fact that religion is primarily a matter of direct experience. Similarly, at the time of Jesus' advent, the externals of the Jewish faith were usurping its inner truth. He came to purify and revivify the religion of the Jews. From time to time, then, a divine incarnation is needed to re-establish the eternal spirit of religion. By his living example, the incarnation shows mankind how to be perfect, even as the Father in heaven is perfect. The avatar thus really becomes the way, the truth, and the life, but it is always the same Supreme Spirit which embodies itself in the avatar. God is one without a second. He who came as Sri Krishna and as Buddha came again as Christ and as other avatars. He merely chose a different dress. To suit the particular needs of successive ages with each coming, God reveals a new and characteristic presentation of the eternal truth of religion. When an avatar is born on earth, he assumes the human body with certain consequent limitations and sufferings, such as hunger and thirst, illness and death. But his advent differs radically from the birth of ordinary embodied souls. In the words of Jesus, "Ye are from beneath, I am from above." According to the Hindu view, ordinary souls are born in consequence of their karmas, the effects of their thoughts and deeds of the past. They are born in a particular environment with particular aptitudes dictated by the desires and tendencies they have created in a previous life. They are products of evolution. They are tied by the fetters of ignorance and live under the spell of Maya, the veiling power of Brahman, which makes the absolute reality appear as the universe of many names and forms. They are slaves of Prakriti, of primordial nature. The birth of a Krishna, a Buddha, or a Jesus, however, is the result of free choice. He has no karmas, no cravings or past tendencies. He does not yield to the domination of Maya, but puts Maya under subjection. He appears in human form solely for the purpose of doing good, out of compassion for mankind. Sri Krishna says, "I am the birthless, the deathless, Lord of all that breathes. I seem to be born. It is only seeming, only my Maya. I am still master of my Prakriti, the power that makes me. He who knows the nature of my task and my holy birth is not reborn when he leaves this body. He comes to me." Compare with these last lines the words of the Bible. "But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name." To worship a Christ or a Krishna is to worship God. It is not, however, to worship a man as God, not to worship a person. It is to worship God himself, the impersonal, personal existence in and through the incarnation. It is to adore him as one with the eternal spirit, transcendent as the Father and eminent in all hearts. In this context, St. Paul's testimony about Christ is of special relevance. He says, For in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and ye are complete in him which is the head of all principality and power. Of equal weight is St. John's statement that the same Word which was in the beginning and was God was made flesh in Christ. In this passage, the author of the fourth gospel reminds us that his master was not a mere historical man, but that he is the eternal Christ, one with God from beginningless time. And this view seems to be validated by Jesus, who said, "Before Abraham was, I am." A Hindu, then, would find it easy to accept Christ as a divine incarnation and to worship him unreservedly, exactly as he worships Sri Krishna or another avatar of his choice. But he cannot accept Christ as the only Son of God. Those who insist on regarding the life and teachings of Jesus as unique are bound to have great difficulty in understanding them. Any avatar can be far better understood in the light of other great lives and teachings. No divine incarnation ever came to refute the religion taught by another, but to fulfill all religions, because the truth of God is an eternal truth. St. Augustine said, "That which is called the Christian religion existed among the ancients, and never did not exist from the beginning of the human race until Christ came in the flesh, at which time the true religion, which already existed, began to be called Christianity." If, in the history of the world, Jesus had been the sole originator of the truth of God, it would be no truth. For truth cannot be originated. It exists. But if Jesus simply unfolded and interpreted that truth, then we may look to others who did so before him, and will do so after him. And in fact, as we read the teachings of Jesus, we find that he wishes all of us to unfold that truth. "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." He has come, he declares, not to destroy the eternally existing truth, but to fulfill. This he did by restating it, giving it new life by presenting it in a new way. Again and again, men forget that these presentations of the divine incarnations are meant to be unfolded in their own lives. They cling too devotedly to the letter, the outward form of the avatar's message, and lose sight of its undying spirit. These are the scribes and Pharisees, the jealous guardians of a tradition which has become obsolete. That is why Christ says, "For I say unto you, that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." The scribes and Pharisees forget the first commandment to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. They are very ethical, upright men in their own way, but they cling to forms and outward observances, and this leads them towards intolerance, narrowness, and dogmatism. The righteousness which exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees is the very opposite of this. It is an ethic which regards the observance of forms and rituals not as an end in itself, but as a means to enter into the kingdom of heaven. God is beyond relative good and evil. He is the absolute good. When we unite ourselves with him in our consciousness, we transcend relative righteousness. This truth has often been misunderstood. It does not mean that we should condone immorality, for ethical life is the very foundation of spirituality. At the beginning of spiritual life, we must consciously abstain from harming others, from falsehood, theft, incontinence, and greed. We must observe mental and physical purity, contentment, self-control, and recollectedness of God. but the urge to live a truly ethical life and to practice spiritual disciplines comes to us only if we try to live the first commandment, if we learn to love God and struggle to realize Him. Without that ideal, morality degenerates into the external decorum of the scribes and Pharisees. But when the first commandment is observed, then the second commandment follows as a matter of course. When we love God, we must love our neighbor as ourself, because our neighbor is our very self. Through the practice of self-control, the inner restraint of the passions, we develop spiritually towards the union with the absolute good. The man who attains this ultimate state does not have to discriminate consciously between right and wrong or practice self-mastery. Holiness and purity become his very nature. He transcends relative righteousness and enters the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, Thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, Thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. It is not enough to obey the commandment, Thou shalt not kill. Even the thought of killing, of hatred, is as deadly as the act. We may pretend to ourselves that it does not matter what we think, as long as we act rightly. But when the test comes, we always betray ourselves, for the thought controls the act. When the test comes, if our minds are full of hatred, that hatred will express itself in acts of violence and destruction and murder. Standing up in the pulpit and talking about love will not help us. It will not stop war and cruelty when there is no love in our hearts. Love will not come to us simply because we say we have it or try to impress other people with the seeming sweetness of our natures. It comes only when we have control.